Welcome to join in again. And we do this hand gesture, which if you can grab someone next to you to show you during the break. But basically, you link your little fingers and your pointer fingers and then stick. And then let's see. How am I going to? And then the ring fingers stick straight up. It's one of these things where I can do it.
If you grab your pinky fingers with your thumbs.
There you go. Grab your pinky fingers with your thumbs. Grab your, what are these called?
Cross your middle fingers. And grab,
cross your middle fingers and then grab them with your pointers. There we go.
It's easy when you're just a bystander. Just to throw in the little, it's easy when you're just sitting to the side, throw in a little comment.
Yeah. It's one of those things when you do it and then you try and break it down and talk about it all at the same time. And so what this if any of you were at Geshe Sultram's teaching this weekend, he talked about this with the four continents and Mount Meru, and this is the idea again of a pure world, like a world like that we want to create. That's really brings it back to our intention of why are we here, and it's because we think that we and the world around us can be a different place, right? It can be a better place. And that's really our fundamental, a happier place, a place where we react with compassion and wisdom and loving kindness. And then we offer this again to the Buddha. And part of this is that the Buddha taught us basically that we're not allowed to teach unless there's a request to teach, which is part of why you don't have Buddhists knocking on your door with flyers. So this is the request to teach, right? And then we take refuge. So we're going to start with a meditation. And this meditation is called Tonglen. It's another compassion meditation, and it's a little more complex visualization than what we were doing up till now in the class. But I think it's really a lovely meditation to be able to do as a compassion response. So find a stable seat, one where you're comfortable, alert. You're welcome to sit on chairs, cushions, or even lie down in Shavasana if that's where you can be most comfortable and relaxed and alert at the same time. And closing your eyes. Feel your knees resting on the ground or your feet resting on the floor. And as you do this, explore the palette of some physical, felt, tactile sensations. It's a chance for your mind to let go of all the racing around it's done all day, to withdraw from external stimulation and come into a single sense field of the felt, tactile, physical sensations. You can feel your sit bones, the solidity of your sit bones as they rest on the cushion or the chair. And then from this seat, draw your spine up long. Feel it rising almost as if it's lifting up through the crown of your head. Allowing your inner gaze to fall in towards your heart. And see if you can feel there your wish for others to be free from all suffering. This is a way of setting our intention. Just something very simple. How lovely, how wonderful it would be if there is no one in the world suffering from hunger or thirst, from fear, from abuse. It's a wish that we all have within us. And then in your mind's eye, see this wish taking the form of a tiny, bright, white diamond that's resting in a small, open red rose at the level of your heart, inside your heart space. Some people, visualizations come very easily. If you don't get it clearly, just, that's okay. Just feel some faith that it's there, a bright white diamond resting in a red rose in the center of your heart space. Now bring to mind one being you know who's unwell or unhappy. It could be a relative or a friend or a pet. And the pain, it could be emotional or physical. Maybe even they're lonely or afraid or hungry. But see them, it's almost like you, they can't see you, but you're up looking at them, invisibly there, but you can see them very clearly. You might see the expression of the pain in their body, in their face. And then feel your wish for them to be free of this pain. And make a decision that you are ready to do whatever you can to make that pain vanish. And now imagine that you're sitting right in front of them. They still can't see you. And you see the quality of their pain, physical or mental, identify it clearly. And then begin to see all the pain that they have in their body or their mind begins to take the form of this black, smoky substance through their body. And then you begin to see it as it draws in to gather into a little pool of darkness at their heart, like a small black cloud, about the size of a quarter or a half dollar. It becomes very densely gathered right at their heart. And then again, feeling that sense of wanting to take their pain away, determined to take their pain away. We begin to draw it out of our body, out of their bodies, by using our breath. So on every inhalation, we begin to see that black tarry smoke draw up from their heart, slowly out their nostrils. And each breath brings it closer to us till it begins to hover in a little tiny black cloud right in front of our nostrils. So take some breaths to do that. And then when that all the inky smoke, tarry substance has left their body and gathered in a little cloud right in front of your nostrils, you again take a moment to look at the shining diamond in the rose or feel it there, sparkling, radiant with light. You recognize the power of this diamond is that it can destroy any pain that touches it. So you know that the power of this diamond can destroy all of the smoky, tarry, black pain that you've gathered and taken away from your loved one. Friend, pet. And this is because truly our own willingness to take away, to take someone's pain away from them, destroys that pain forever. And if we're willing to take it on ourselves, we actually don't take it on, it gets destroyed. So none of it stays with us. And on a breath in a moment, what we're going to do is breathe it in one breath inside, but it will touch the diamond and in, like a mini explosion, it is just evaporated into nothing and the diamond will shine brighter than ever. There will be nothing left of the pain. And so take another moment to just breathe and feel and see the diamond. And then in an instant, in one breath, breathe that cloud in, see it, touch the diamond, and like a flash, the cloud is destroyed. And when you've done that, all you can see is a diamond glistening in the rose. Sometimes I like to see a tiny little wisp of the kind of whitish smoke vanish into the air. It's the last little bit of the pain disappearing. And all the pain is gone. And it's very important to have this sense, this confidence that all the pain is truly gone. And it will never touch anyone again. And to feel a moment of joy for having been the one who destroyed it. And you look over at the one from whom you were taking the pain, and you see them again, and now you see their face. They don't know who, they don't know how, they don't know why, but their pain has been lifted. Whatever it was that was bothering or worrying or weighing them down is gone. And so really see that in them, whether it's a physical illness or a heart pain. So for just another moment, sitting invisibly, silently with this being, just enjoying the look on their face, the different easy movement of their body. And then releasing all appearances, just allowing yourself again to sit silently, feeling the breath flowing in and out of the body. Then allowing your awareness to re-engage with the room, bringing movement back in, maybe wiggling your fingers and toes, and as you're ready, opening your eyes. So that's a meditation that can be really helpful to do when we feel compassion, like we see someone who is suffering and we don't quite know what to do. And we want to have a feeling of being able to do something. And whether this actually takes their pain away or not, that's a whole long discussion that we could have, and that would take up about 5 classes. So what I can say is at the moment, that what you can feel is that, Jess, you're right. There's, I keep wanting to say hi over there, but there you are. Hi. Hi. Good to see you. And what it does is, one of the things that we touched on last week was this feeling of sometimes overwhelm when we're working with compassion, and a feeling like, well, what can we really do? And you'll find this is called Tonglen. This is giving and taking, and actually it's taking and giving. So this is the step of taking someone's pain away, and then the full meditation goes into giving them the opposite. On the out-breath, then you give them the opposite. So if they were feeling lonely, you give them, you see them getting friends, you give them all happiness. And so what it does is it begins to really develop our own heart to be responsive in a wise way and in a compassionate way. And it helps combat that feeling that there's nothing to do, and all sorts of wonderful things happen through the practice. So welcome to everyone. And what I'd like to do first is just say hi to someone near you, introduce yourself, and like that.
Is it cold for everyone else, or just for me?
It's okay. 5 or 10. It's okay. If it gets very hotter than that, people start falling asleep.
I mean, I got the apartment, and I'm moving out this weekend.
Congratulations! Yay!
That's
so
exciting. Finally.
Yay, that's amazing.
It was funny, actually, because the executive director position for UBC got posted today, so I was, like, looking at it, and I'm qualified for it, but I was like, that would be so creepy if I took Jess's apartment and then
her job. Oh, it was her apartment.
Yeah, I found that apartment.
Okay.
I'm not doing that, but that was so
this class is on the Brahma-Viharas, the four immeasurables. Immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. And go to the next slide. There we are. And it comes from the main sutra. It was spoken by the Buddha in the Digha Nikaya Suttas, the collection of long discourses, so that it's always good. We like to give our sources so that you know that whoever's here didn't just decide to randomly make stuff up, right? We have some good stories about that, but I'll refrain. Next. And the practice overall is the wish, and again, I have this in the Tibetan Buddhist form rather than the Hinayana Buddhist form. May all mother sentient beings have happiness in its causes. And that's what we went over for the first couple of weeks, right? That's loving kindness. And then may all mother sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. And that's what we're on now, which is, that's compassion. And then immeasurable compassion, because there's a difference between just compassion and immeasurable compassion. May all mother sentient beings never be separated from the bliss that knows no suffering. And that's sympathetic joy, or immeasurable joy. And may all mother sentient beings dwell in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and aversion. And that is immeasurable equanimity, which again we'll go over in our final class next week. But the little preview of that is, I just like to tag it that isn't sitting here in equanimity, feeling nothing no matter what happens, right? Like, oh, I'm going to be peaceful, and people around me can be dying, but I'm going to be peaceful, right? It's not like that. It's that you're wishing everybody free of whether they're dear to you or not, whether they're your political party or not, that they all be happy, they all have well-being, that they all are free of suffering and its causes, we should say, and its causes, and that all of them have developed their good qualities, right? So we, next slide. We went through immeasurable love, and we talked about how the Buddha had used this image of like a mother loves and protects her only child, the feeling of loving kindness that a mother, so it's a feeling of well-being, wishing other beings well, right? That comes, and I'm going like this, because it comes out from our hearts, right? It's something we want them to have wellness, we want them to have ease, we want them to have all the good things. We want, and we, I always like to say, when we do this in practice, it's both the mundane things, like we want them to have enough food, right? So, because we need that. We want, that's a part of being well, and that's an important part of being well. So we don't think of it just being spiritual wellness. It's like all levels we want them to have, all right? And so we did the practice of loving kindness. And next, I think I may have put the wrong one on there. Yeah, next I did. You got, somehow we got the old one.
I had four, what was it?
It's supposed to be five. Do you want to hand it back to me and I'll see if I can find it? Let's see. This is a, it's on there, it's the right one. So if you go to the folder called the Four Immeasurables, and then you look inside that folder, it should say Four Immeasurables 5 PDF. Is it on there? It's on the flash.
I don't see it on the one that you just...
Okay, anyway. If we, we'll try again at the break if we can't find it. So anyway, now we're on to the second immeasurable, which we started last week, which is the immeasurable compassion, right? So what did we say compassion was? And what's the difference between love and compassion?
I felt concerned for others, whatever pain or suffering it might be.
Concern with their other, with their pain and suffering, yeah. Anybody else?
Love meeting suffering.
Love meeting suffering, right? Yeah. When our love meets the suffering, then what we give rise to is compassion. Yeah. And so compassion or karuna arises when we really feel the suffering, when our heart quivers, right, in with the suffering of other living beings. And what the wish here is that may all mother sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. And we haven't even gone over the its causes parts for these yet. Right? That's what I was hoping to do next week, so we'll see. And I noticed, I don't know how you felt last week, but it felt again like there was a lot of emotion in the room as we were talking about compassion and when we did the compassion meditation. And one of the things that came up in our discussion was... Gesundheit. What do we do when we're practicing compassion and we start to feel overwhelmed by it, right? What do we feel, how do we deal with it when the feelings that come up, like I'm imagining one of the newspaper images or someone that I know that's like really suffering, maybe dying and afraid, maybe really sick, and what happens is, what I feel like is I'm just starting to go into a little tear meltdown, right? So I wanted to know two things. One I'm going to cycle back to, but where am I going to start? Let's see. So a couple things, there are a few things. One is that the Buddha actually talked a lot of, in his language about psychology and emotion, and we don't really think about it that much. And our Western language is much more naturally about emotion than it is philosophy. And so we tend to use really more emotional, psychological language. But if you line it up with Buddhist studies, you really find that a lot of it, just, it's amazing how much of it overlaps. So we look at things like what the Buddha taught about the kleshas, and he called them the afflictive emotions, and they're things like jealousy. You know, and they're afflictive emotions because they are afflictive states of mind. That sounds very like philosophical, right? But really what it means is it's just things that we don't like to feel. they're afflictive. They hurt. It hurts us to feel jealousy. It hurts us to feel anger. It hurts us to feel envy, you know? And so he said, well, how are we going to work with these things? So I don't want to say that there's a crossover in language and thought there. And one of the things that I notice is when we sit down and start meditating, there's a lot of us that have a whole wellspring of grief and unfelt emotions. Has anyone noticed that? Yeah? No. Jess is like, no, never. Never felt that. So one of the things that happens is when we start to just open the window a little crack, like say, we're going to do a compassion practice, and I'm like, yeah, this is going to be really fun. And then we start and we get a little break, a little heart opening, and it's like a crack in the dam. You know what I mean? It's like, so when I was about 16 or something like that, I was a junior counselor up in Orville, which is up near Marysville. And in the middle of camp, I was out, it was lunchtime, and it was my duty, it was my round to do the dishes that day. So for whatever reason, I had to run out and get something from the storehouse. So I ran from the building, which was the lunch building where everybody else was, and I walked out. All of a sudden, I look up, and it's like, you know, we all know this landscape. It's like oaks and lots of grassy fields, and the grassy fields are coming at me in waves, like this. And I'm like, what the heck? And then the next thing I know, I'm standing on solid ground that's literally like standing on an earth ocean. And it was wild. And I looked over, because it went on for a while. I think it ended up being something like a 6.8 or 7.1, somewhere in there, earthquake. And the whole dining room, kitchen complex, was like an accordion, like this. It was the wildest thing to see a solid building going in and out like that. And then as it went on, all of a sudden the in and out building was disgorging a stream of running children. And all of a sudden it's like, there was only me, and then there were these children pouring out, which is the wrong thing to do when you have an earthquake that's going like this. Right? But everyone was okay. But then we were on alert because we were downstream from the Orville Dam. And what they were saying is, even though it was, you know, they supposedly protected in an earthquake, it just would take one little crack in the right place and the whole thing would blow, right? And so they, I think, as I remember, they did a lot of releasing in the side channel of the little gates so that they could relieve some of the pressure behind it while they examined it and so on. So I was thinking that, it's like that. That's sometimes my image when I'm working with emotions. And it's a little bit like if I let my heart crack open, it could blow. It's kind of like my whole body feels like on alert sometimes. Like, is it going to blow? Or can I have a controlled flow out that kind of releases the pressure? So I think, does that make sense? You know? So that's like in our meditation, that's skillfully working with it. And in that way, there's no one else that has their foot on the gas or the brake except you, right? Like, I'm not in any of your heads saying, all right, push it a little bit more. no, you know, now just follow your breath and relax and kind of recalibrate. And that's the skill of meditation. It's like, how much can I feel without getting flooded? And how can I how can I feel enough so I'm not just keeping shut down? All right? So that's really the personal responsibility and art and pleasure of meditating, because as you get it, you actually increase your capacity to feel more and more. It's like the flow that comes out begins, the heart begins to melt more from ice, that icy part of the heart begins to melt more and more, and you begin to live in this warm flow, and it starts to feel better, even though at first it's like, it's uncomfortable. So that's one thing I wanted to just acknowledge. So it's not unusual that as soon as we start doing heart practices, we can have tears, and we can feel like, I don't know what to do with this. It just feels a little overwhelming. And then I wanted to mention the Buddha talked about two things. This is with, again, he used the image of the child. As parents who, on seeing the suffering of their dear and only child, feel compassion for it, saying, oh, how it suffers, so one feels compassion for all beings. This is immeasurable compassion. See, because it's immeasurable because there's no end to your compassion, your caring for others, wanting to see, remove their suffering. And it's immeasurable because it's for all living beings. And I don't know what anyone's political beliefs are or what side you come down on. And I don't make any assumptions because I've made assumptions before and then been really surprised.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter. What matters is I want to speak to the division and that feeling of catching. And what I'm hearing in our political rhetoric, which is a lack of loving kindness and a lack of compassion. Yeah. So it's kind of like, I'm going to have love and compassion, except for the other guys. So I listen to the other guys' news stations and radio stations sometimes very intentionally. And that's my part of my practice is, seriously, it is. Because if I can't do it for the people.
Like, whoa.
I know, it's kind of funny. It's really, I mean, that really isn't like, it doesn't hurt you, I promise. Yeah, I mean, maybe it does if your mind goes, well, yeah, maybe it does.
See, I usually do just the opposite. I read the editorial page, and if I see a letter that disagrees with me a lot, I try not to read it.
Yeah, if it's that, I mean, that is what is in the backup and say it could hurt you, because if it upsets you uncontrollably or it gives rise to an anger or something like that, then that is actually time to stop. So the far enemy is cruelty. So remember, each immeasurable has a near enemy and a far enemy. A far enemy is basically the opposite. And the Buddha said the flip side of compassion is cruelty, to intentionally cause harm, to intentionally cause someone else to suffer. That makes sense, right? Compassion is saying, I want these beings, because you've got to remember, it's not just people. We're talking about all living beings, so animals as well. We don't want them to suffer. I want to take their suffering away. So the opposite of that would be to cause it, to want to cause it, to have the intent to cause it, to get some pleasure in causing it. Okay. Do I need to say more about that, or is that pretty? Usually the far enemy is really clear because it's so cut and dry. It's like, yeah. No. All right. Now, the near enemy has different modes. And one of them is overwhelming grief or sorrow. Sometimes it's called overwhelming sorrow or pity or idiot compassion, which was Trungpa Rinpoche's phrase, which I love. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to have a little idiot compassion for you today. So we'll get to that. So I wanted to talk about that. And the first one is grief or sorrow. I think I have a slide. I do. Maybe I don't. I don't. Never mind. So grief and sorrow is the difference between this and compassion. Like, what's the difference between grief and compassion? Any
idea?
If you're
rendered helpless by overwhelming grief and sorrow, and you haven't used it, let alone grief.
Yeah. Did everyone hear that?
No.
I'm normally pretty loud.
Yeah, but I need to hear it. It's not your fault.
She said you're usually rendered helpless by grief and unable to help anyone or do anything from there.
Yeah. So you can't help anyone else, let alone yourself, right? Because that's exactly what the Buddha said. It's like we might be aware of someone's suffering and go overwhelmingly into that grief or sorrow. And we then feel even more dreadful because we want to help, but we can't. And I love this phrase that I've been really working with recently, which is, there are some things that cannot be fixed, they can only be carried. Right? There are some things that cannot be fixed, they can only be carried. What does that mean? It means there are some traumas, then some losses. Like a friend of mine who lost her baby at birth, you know. That is not a loss that I could go and fix. And so when I was with her afterwards, one of the things she was saying was how hard it is to hear, well, there's a blessing in this, or there's some kind of strength that's going to come out of this, or you'll learn a lesson for this, or something like that. It doesn't mean that that isn't true. It could be true, but that has to come organically from her. And even if it does come, it doesn't mean that the pain of the loss necessarily goes away, right? She feels that loss, and part of what happens is her love for her son and her pain of the loss are together. So if you stop her from talking about the loss, you stop her from talking about her love, and vice versa, right? So you need to be able to be big enough to hold both of them, and that's what I mean by caring, right? We're not trying to fix it and make that pain go away. We're trying to be compassionate enough to be with someone in their pain and allow them to go through whatever their process is and how their life unfolds. And sometimes it's just being there with them, right? Not making any suggestions, not... I thought about this a couple times. It's like a father who... it's always the dads that try and teach the kids to ride bikes. I think maybe it's the mom, Jean, is like, no! The first time this happened with my daughter when she was 6 years old, we moved to Davis, and it was like, okay, she's got to learn to ride a bike. So, you know, he's running along behind her, and I'm watching on the university property, I'm watching up from the hill, and it's all really cool, and everything's good. And then he lets go, right? And then I'm like, ah! And sure enough, she goes right into the one lamppost.
There.
Like, whole open field, like, zoom! But the thing is that what I realized is she can't learn to ride unless he lets go, right? So she needs him there to kind of be the holding container, the one that kind of gets her, help her. But you can't do it for her. And it's the same with compassion, right? We need to be willing. Like, if we really look deeply, it's hard for us to be with someone and not feeling like we want to do something for them. And really, if we look a level deeper than that, it's because of our own discomfort. Right? And so it's actually kind of a selfish, clinging attachment to our own comfort that's getting in the way. If we're really, really honest with ourselves, that's usually it. So, and I've noticed, I mean, once I figured this out some years ago, I started watching, and I noticed, like, homeless person comes up, and I'm not in the mood to deal with it. I feel irritated instead of compassionate. And I realize I'm irritated because you are a mirror to something I don't want to feel. And so I'm pissed off at you right now, right? Because you're making me feel that and I don't want it. Yeah. So that's like a subtle level of that comes in when we're with someone in grief and just there. To not be overwhelmed is to be able to be there as a bigger presence. Which brings us to something that I call merging or fusing with, right? And compassion is a warm, caring emotion, but it does not involve, say, feeling sad because if the other person is sad. Okay? It doesn't mean feeling traumatized if the other person is traumatized. Anyone who's done psychology work probably, or you've been trained as a social worker or psychologist, this is familiar. And it's one of the things the Buddha said. He said it in his language, and it lines up with what we know about humans and so on more and more. And one of the things that I found looking into this, because I thought, how am I going to talk about this? And I found out that there are actually studies about this that I didn't know. And one of them is that, you know, we know that empathy is a precursor to compassion. But what they find is too much empathy makes people shut down instead of open up eventually. Because, for instance, healthcare workers I was a nurse midwife for years. I saw this. Nurses who gave themselves all the time, they would burn out and then they would end up doing some... The big thing was, I got a job at Kaiser as an advice nurse. I work 8 hours a day, and I'm on the phone, and I've got a little book here, you know, that's all with everything. Yeah. So what's interesting is they did these studies with healthcare workers, and they did the whole brain scan thing, and then they played videos. And what they found was that people who had these high levels of empathy and were starting to co-feel with in such a deep way, their brain part that actually registers pain was lighting up, right? So to the point where they were literally feeling pain. They were feeling whatever part of the brain it was. It's like there is this fusing, this merging. And then it was to such an extent, they actually felt the suffering, right? So why is that an issue?
Because then it makes them not want to be empathetic.
What's that?
Then you don't want to be compassionate.
Right, because you actually, the Buddha said, that's not compassion, right? It's exactly what Dasha said. Like, if you go to fall into a puddle of suffering, then you're suffering, you're embodying the pain, and it undermines your ability or my ability to create a holding environment. So what do I mean?
You mean it undermines the person's sufferings, their ability, when we feel what they feel?
When we feel what they feel, honestly, it's kind of a very odd thing for them. I mean, think about it. Here's my example to kind of go, let me go through it step by step. So, because the flip side was then someone got interested and they said, I want to study the brains of Buddhist monks who practice compassion. What are they like when I flash these same videos in front of them? And what they found was the parts of the brain that lit up for them were those of nurturing, caring, and social connection. All right? Not pain and suffering part of their brain. And one of the monks, Matteo Ricard, who's been called the happiest person alive, he really has. When he was asked what he was meditating on, what he was thinking, he said he was activating a warm, loving, caring feeling which a mother would activate towards a crying child. Right? So which a mother would activate or a parent would activate toward a crying child. That's what I mean by a holding environment. Right? The mom, so this is cutting back to what you say. Imagine a kid in your arms crying. You're the mom. You look down, you start to feel their pain, and you break down in tears, and you start sobbing. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's really the same thing.
That's not going to help the baby.
Yeah.
Right, so all of a sudden you have, and then you lay the baby down, and the baby's having a fit and crying, and the mom's laying down next to it having a fit and crying. Does the baby feel safe? Probably not. Does the baby feel nurtured? Probably not, right? Is their process undermined? Probably. That's what I mean. Okay? So it's like that. The thing that compassion is like the mother or loving arms that hold the baby while the baby's crying. And so the mother feels compassion for the baby, wants the suffering to end. And if you've ever been a parent at 2 a.m, you really want that crying to end. And sometimes it's not all compassionate. But it's a sense that the nurturing, connected, caring part of your heart is open, and you're big enough to hold that baby with that and not fuse and go into your own meltdown crying. Okay? Trying to find the quote. I've got so into this, I have 14 pages of notes. You know how many Aisha get through in an evening? 4.
Is that the near end of your teaching or the far end of your teaching?
Okay, so I just wanted to say, because does this sound kind of like psycho-emotional American talk? Yeah? All right.
No, it doesn't. What do you mean?
No, it doesn't. Well, I mean, like, I'm talking about holding and nurturing and caring and fusing versus Buddhist, you know.
Yeah.
So I just had to tell you what the Buddha said. The Buddha said, when we break down into tears in the face of other people's suffering, he called it wallowing in a sorrowful pit, bottomless pit of pain. Okay. I shouldn't laugh.
That's about right.
But he says, what it is he said, because we're generating pain in response to pain. It's bottomless, he said, because there's no end to that. And he says, but this wallowing isn't necessary. And his quote, one of the quotes was, when a well-taught, noble disciple, that's us, okay? You all are well-taught, noble disciples, is afflicted by these painful feelings, she or he will not worry or grieve and lament or beat their breasts and weep, nor be distraught. And thus they, that one who can withstand the bottomless pit, has gained a foothold in it. Right? So that's basically what I just was talking about. And he goes on and on over paragraphs as explaining this as a practice. And this is when he's talking about the near enemy of what is often translated sorrow or grief or overwhelming grief as the near enemy of compassion. So he pointed out this very thing 2,500 years ago. Right? So I just want to again touch down that I'm using this kind of modern language and examples that resonate with us because it's our language. But it's exactly what the Buddha taught when he's touching of saying, if you do that, if you don't practice this holding environment, creating this ability to hold, then what will happen is we'll become the other person's suffering rather than being able to meet that suffering with love. Yeah. And then it goes on and talks about, and we could talk about this more because I've got 14 pages of notes. But one of the things that happens is just to think about that, is how much of this is really the definition of our own ego involvement. And that's the difference between measureless compassion, is it's as we become better and better at leaving our own ego out, not our feelings. We have to acknowledge our feelings, okay? If we don't acknowledge our own feelings, our own needs, our own experience, it's another way of actually being very egoic, because we're just ignoring it instead of being overwhelmed by it. So we have to be able to recognize them, work with them, acknowledge them, and then kind of really feel, but wait, I have suffering. I see this other being suffering, and I really have love for them, and it's going to meet the compassion. And I can put my own experience on the back burner for a minute. I mean, this is kind of how I talk to myself sometimes. Like, you can put your own experience on the back burner a moment. You've got the inner resources to be able to, you know, get back to it. And right now, this other person needs you, so take care of them. Right? I don't know if that makes sense to people. Yeah?
Can you still consider it compassion if you, like, have a recognition that, maybe that individual has, you know, some responsibility in whatever situation that they might be in? And, you know, I'm sorry that you're feeling this way, that you're hurt, but...
Absolutely, because... The Buddha said part of the unmeasurable part of compassion is it doesn't mean, and this is kind of idiot compassion, this gets into idiot compassion. Our idea of idiot compassion is either A, I'm a doormat, or B, I let everyone else off the hook. Like, we always go into these either or. Like, if I do this, it means this, right? You can totally, it's a both and situation. The Buddha taught that our compassion actually is immeasurable, in that we feel it equally to a kid who's separated from his toy as we do to a, say a soldier who lost a limb. It's because what we're responding to is human suffering, and so we have compassion for that, and we don't want the other person, we don't want people to feel any of that range, right? And then you say you can still hold them responsible. Right? You're not letting them off the hook for what they did, but you meet them with an attitude of compassion. And if you can really do that, often what you'll find is people then, you've created a holding environment. It's like learning to ride a bike. People will often step up and do their own process within that, and then they can see, because they feel safe enough, like a kid crying, then often what will happen is they'll be able to take that responsibility for themselves. They'll be able to get that insight for themselves because you're doing this for them with compassion.
But in my mind, I'm thinking kind of about what you said about the homeless. Not so much irritation, but the sense that I feel bad that you're in this situation, but there's really nothing I can do about it. And especially when I see young people that look able-bodied on the side of the freeway asking for money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I see someone that's really old, I think, oh, well, maybe you can't get it. Mm-hmm. Your health is the issue, whatever. So when it's
Okay, let me.
A young person, I'm kind of like, well, you could probably get some kind of work.
Right. And so let's take a break and then address that. And we'll address that. Like I said, I think I'm going to let everything else about compassion go and go right to practices. And that, so, because otherwise we won't get to sympathetic joy. And we want to leave happy tonight, right? Okay, so let's take there's tea and some snacks and water and take a little break. And I'll ring the bell to come back in about 5 to 10 minutes. Put some on the board and see what people want to take them on the
Yeah, I want to make a sign that says, that suggests taking a photo of the flyers instead of looking at them. Because, like, we all have smartphones now, and it's like less resources and, if
they want to. Or take a flyer, because then I think that there's something physical in your universe. So I'm sorry, I didn't actually hear the second part you said. You said you looked at it, you got it, and then sometimes when you look at it.
Oh, Jess's apartment, yeah. So I got it, and then they posted on the and so I was just like looking at the everything, and it's funny because it's like the position I am qualified for. I'm not going to apply for it. But I was just thinking it'd be so funny if I took Jess's apartment and then like then became a second person of the yoga. It would be so creepy if I'm taking over her life.
And so it was just that weird, like,
you're like, no, I can't do this.
I know, one of the fact that those opportunities came up so close right. together.
Uh-huh.
It's just, it was just like, whoa, that's really
yeah. So, what? Did you have a moment of, oh, that would be a really cool position? Or was
no,
it like,
I was just looking, because you know, I work in nonprofit, so I always look at like qualifications and like salaries and just to kind of see what's out there. Actually, I'm not particularly qualified because I don't have my certification, but like the actually the minimum requirements are very small. I think they only require like 2 years of nonprofits for an ED. That's, but also the salary is not. I mean, it's not a bad salary, but for a project director, it's probably pretty low. But they're a small nonprofit, so it makes sense. It's just, you know.
But that is kind of funny.
I know. Yeah, it's funny that it just happened. Right, I probably wouldn't have thought about it if it happened like a month before.
Right, but like just be like, okay, what's gonna come next?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and then I also made this. I don't know, I made a couple of versions and I kept adding things, right?
Oh, cool.
But I thought that might be a nice like snapshot of all of what we're offering.
Oh, I like that.
I wanted to put retreats here, but then I realized like there were all retreats. I don't really like social events, but...
I kind of like it, it's fun. I mean, I know what you mean, but I think it's a big hug, but it also, I think, there's a safe special, something goes off in people's brains, so I think that's okay.
It's like a one-time only thing, and people go, oh, well, I have to, like, this with these courses, it's like, oh, I'll just miss and I'll start next week, this is like, no, this is it.
Well, that's a good
hug. Yeah. And I thought it was like a nice, like, because it shows, like, things that we have weekly are one-time events, and then as we add more service stuff, we can add more.
Right. One thing I was thinking, now that we, especially over time, we really do need to be putting our diamond light logo and everything just for branding.
Yeah. Do you think it would look good here, down here, or I should make this picture? I should take this picture and put the logo here.
We should probably put the logo there. I really like the picture. Yeah. Isn't that good with branding? That's kind of what I remember.
I agree, and I thought about it. I was like, oh, where should I put the logo? But it didn't really seem to be anywhere, and so I just left off for now.
Oh, good. I never even touched this yet.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
How are you?
Good.
Yeah, we'll find a place to put it, and maybe we'll take the picture off.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's awesome.
Compassion without, you know, that's compassion.
Does that mean that it's Zen?
It is. It's a,
so it's a different practice.
It's a different form, but you know, as
I'm just in the first chapter. It tells the story of the prince had fineries, and then he was dissatisfied and he went anyway. became Buddha by giving up everything.
We all have our own take on the Buddhist practice. When it's went to India, where we live.
Okay.
And then it traveled down to Sri Lanka, over to Burma, into Tibet, China, over to Japan. And like, if
it's more of the
more of it is highly interesting, we all use the same basic talks and the same stories and the same
language.
So I haven't looked at that for ages. It's been around for a long time.
Okay.
And but I, and it's funny because when I traveled in Asia, I think it was even when I traveled in India, like in the 80s, and went to a hotel.
I did, yes. I found. I think this is what you were talking about.
Oh, yeah. Wow, well, you found it.
I just got
it.
Okay. Except for the print is so small. My big reader.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is more of a really limited
depth. All right.
Yeah, good luck.
I'll start with that one. And I'll chip away at this one.
And somewhere I have a bibliography of people who are beginners, so it's not quite me. Great. Oh yeah, we have the, I put the announcements on the PDF there, the file again. Who's going to do announcements?
No.
You want to do it?
No.
No?
You got to let me prepare.
Okay, next week.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to see you guys tonight. We're Diamond Light Tibetan Buddhist Group, and we put on a lot of different classes and workshops. And so this class that Lamami is teaching ends next week, right? That's your last class.
It's my last one for a while.
The last one of this series, and we might continue on when you get back, I don't know. And so starting the following week is FPMT Course 4, which is The Need for a Spiritual Teacher, Why Can't I Just Read a Book? And so Venerable Gautam Palmo is going to be teaching that course, and she's a wonderful teacher, and it's going to be 5 weeks, I believe. So hope to see you all there.
And I just want to say about that, it's something, it's actually a question I get a lot. And it's going to be from the traditional Buddhist point of view. But it's something we Americans don't really, it doesn't come naturally to most of us unless we had that experience somewhere in our life of really having a teacher who guides us. And what I mean is it's kind of similar to, like, if you want to learn piano, well, how do I find it? What do I do? Why would I need a teacher? What would I get from a teacher? How would I approach a teacher? How would I make use of a teacher? What's their role? That sort of thing. So I think it's a really useful class, and like that. Just wanted to say.
Yeah, and she's teaching from October 4th through November 16th, I think, or 15th. I think November 15th, and that's on Tuesdays, and it's here. Except she's taking one Tuesday off, which is October 18th, and Sunil has graciously offered to teach a class on compassionate communication. So. I'm not going by the PowerPoint, I'm sorry. I'm going off my in front of me.
If you want to know more about this, raise your hand.
I'm not a certified practitioner, but I'll be drawing a nonviolent communication for that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've been studying for like 10 years, right?
Not continuously, I started 10 years ago.
Yeah. So that's on October 18th. On Wednesday, we're continuing the meditation course. Our first class was last week, so if you're interested in doing a deeper dive into setting up a meditation practice and all the different components of that, this is a class that you should not miss. So it's 10 weeks, and it's on Wednesdays from 6:30 to 8:30 here.
And Heather, raise your hand.
Have you any questions?
Yeah, and then on Thursdays, we're having Thursday night meditation. And Jay and I have been kind of organizing that group, and everyone is welcome, and it's sitting, meditation, and discussion.
That's great.
And it's peer-led.
And it's peer-led.
Which is really cool. So it's real community. And
and we do whatever meditation the group is feeling like, whether it's silent, guided, what kind of guided, and we give each other advice about our meditation practices. And Jenny's been coming, so if you have questions, you can ask.
Come put your raise your hand, Jenny. Thank you.
Yeah. And that's also here. We have a 1 day. Oh, except for next week, we're not having community meditation. We're having Elaine coming on September 9th, and she's teaching beginning meditation and how and why to meditate. And that's Thursday from 6:30 to 8 on the 29th. And then she's going to be doing a full day meditation practice. It's not a full day of meditation. Sorry, that's not what I mean. A full day retreat with meditations from 10 to 4 on October 1st.
And that's a meditation, sitting, walking, discussion, talks. So it goes by, and lunch, a big long lunch break. So it goes by really quickly. But it's a really sweet one to do if you haven't done a longer period of meditating. You know, it's a really, really sweet way to start seeing what it's like when you do it a little bit longer during the day, a little more hours on the cushion.
Yeah, and on November 19th, Venerable Gyaltsen is going to lead us in a practice day, going along with her spiritual guide class.
That's
there it is.
That was it.
November.
So see, Saturday, November
19th. Oh, okay.
It's not a separate, it's with the course.
But you can come anyway.
Yeah, and then the third Friday of every month, we do breakfast for the homeless. And so we need service, we need cash and food donations, and Dasha organizes that. And so if you want to become involved, talk to her, and she will get you on the list.
Third Friday of every month.
Donna Bowles are in the back, and that's how our entire center is run.
And next.
Dasha.
What?
Wait, can you go back one more?
Here.
One more?
It's Brandy.
Okay, is that right? October 2nd? Did I get the date right?
Oh, are we adding another day?
No,
yes,
that's a
we're
Sunday.
Adding another day.
Oh, Sunday morning, that's right.
So we're adding another day because there are certain churches and groups and charities that feed folks in Midtown, Downtown. But if you move out slightly farther out, like towards Broadway, there's a lot of folks who get little or no food simply because they can't walk, it's a long distance. There's some territorial rivalries between homeless, if you didn't know. So we're wanting to extend our reach towards the folks who are sleeping either in their cars or under the bridges. And the first location we're gonna go to on October 2nd is on that corner of Alhambra and Broadway. And under that freeway, there's a lot of folks, except if they get cleaned out by the police, so that might be an empty morning. So we're gonna come out and just start later than the note that we're here, and hopefully that'll build and will create a regular opportunity for them to get a meal on the weekend. And the weekends are actually even the toughest because Monday through Friday, some churches and local shelters feed. Saturday, Sunday, there's one church in downtown I know who feeds, but everybody else just not able to even get to that food. So we're wanting to extend a healthy hand and provide something that we all gladly receive in our own mornings at home.
So if you want to go with Dasha or help prepare that for October 2nd, see her. And it's really, it's like so amazing when we get together, we prepare food, or you just know that you're supporting it by giving whatever donation you can or going and actually handing it out. It's going to be... like the segue here is that one of the things I haven't touched on is the other thing we found out is compassion feels good. Like everybody thinks they want to be loved, but more and more of the studies on happiness are showing that being loving, doing altruistic compassionate acts actually make people feel happier and better and more pro-social behavior and feeling. So if you really want to like get that buzz in your own life, go help Dasha on the second.
Yes, and on the second, we would like to have at least one man with us, just so that since it's our first venture out, we want to have some connection with the male population and just have a little sense of groundedness.
Yeah. Right, not practice idiot compassion. Do this wisely.
Dasha, do you need food for this event too? Or is it just...
If it's available to donate, we are always absolutely welcome. But we do have a bit of a reserve with our breakfast program as it is. So we can start wherever we're at and we'll see how big we can grow it.
Okay.
How do we connect with you?
I can grab your email address to the class.
Cool.
Okay.
And Brandy's teaching in November.
So cute. I couldn't help. I saw
that's
that.
Great.
I couldn't help.
And this is the Lojong practice, and it's similar to the Tonglen that we did today and relieving suffering, right? And this is the same course she taught last.
This is actually, she said it's going to be a Lojong course, but she hasn't gotten me the actual material. It's more like in November, save the date. You know, as soon as Venerable Palma's course ends, Brandy will start teaching. Okay? So I just wanted to give you guys a heads up because it's always exciting and fun when she teaches.
Yeah.
We haven't had her here for a while.
No, we haven't.
So we're back.
There's the
Yeah, and so there's Donables in the back. That's how our entire center is run. And Donna means generous giving, so whatever you are able to give joyfully and freely definitely helps and is rejoiceable. So feel free to put whatever you can joyfully give in the back. That helps us pay our rent, our utilities, you know, all of us that help keep this place going are volunteers. And so if you also are interested in volunteering, we definitely do need help. So you can talk to me or talk to Heather about any skills that you have or just see what the needs are and we can help.
Well, and that's the only income that the center has, right? I mean,
we
depend on that. If y'all, like, the furniture here has all been donated, the napkins and cow are all donated, so we all just put it on with a love in our own hearts to keep these classes going as a way of being a part of the community.
Yeah, and if you can't donate cash, you could come talk to me and Heather, or probably even Dasha, and see if there's anything that you happen to have around your house that we might need, like
a burner.
And a website designer.
Or a dish soap or sponges. Like, there's just things that we need. And so, if you're unable to to give cash, we could also take items. Yeah. I think that's all my notes.
Okay. Yay. And it's fun. It's really fun to get together with community and all that. All right. So, I wanted to touch on a couple last things about compassion. One is another way of getting overwhelmed is when you start reading about all the stuff that needs doing in the world right now. It's like, I can't do it all. What can I do? And then you just kind of end up collapsing. It just feels like I can't do anything because there's so much to do. And it's not going to make a dent. And I learned something from Joanna Macy decades ago, which is what she called an in-place response. Which is you look around, you see what you can do, who you can affect, and who you can impact with the resources that you have, meaning the inner and outer resources, and you do that in the place where you are. It's not, and very few of us can, like if I have a friend who gets on one of those big old 747s that's converted into an operating room when it lands, and the doctors do... the last one she went on was some kind of eye surgery that was fairly simple, but restored a certain level of sight to kids that they didn't have before. That's something that's just kind of routinely done in the U.S. But she flew to several places, and the cool thing was not only did they do the surgery, they brought in local doctors and nurses and taught them how to do it. And then they come back the next year to see how it's going and check up and do some more trainings. And then that one's done. And then they do it the next one. They either come back to the same place with a different kind of surgery or they go on through different places. So not all of us have the skills and resources to do that, right? But for my friend, that's her in-place response because she has the time and the resources and the skills. For us, it may be something very different, like feeding the homeless under the freeway, right? That's an in-place response. And I always go back, when I feel this way, I always go back to the starfish story. Do all you know the starfish story? It's a woman that is walking on the beach, and there's been this wash up of starfish, and they're all dying on the beach, and there are hundreds of them. And somebody sees this woman just throwing starfish in, and he says to her, look at this, it's not going to make a difference. They're all dying, and there's hundreds of them, and you can't get to them fast enough. And she picked up one up and said, it makes a difference to this one. You know? And it's so simple, and it just really is that thing that we underestimate the power of making a difference to that one, right? And I like to think the ripple effect. If you help one person, that ripples out in ways you don't even know. If you help change somebody's life, even a tiny bit, or make it better, just a better mood. You know, they go to the cashier, and they smile at the cashier. The cashier's day is better. It's seriously, you know, don't underestimate it. And so we all kind of backpedal from what we do and we discount it. But just remember that story and think, it makes a difference to this one. And then be happy about that. And then as our own capacity naturally, organically changes, we go and follow that. And sometimes it'll mean we fly off on a big airplane, and other times it means we go and feed the homeless, and they're both good. Okay. And then what are we gonna do? Okay, so daily practices. Bye, Jesse. Take care. A few practices. One is, if it's not on there, but if you're gonna feed. If you come into a situation where you're having trouble having compassion because you think the person's acting like an idiot, right? Or not, they're not taking responsibility. So I'll tell you the story that does it for me, which some of you have heard before. And it's a true story, that there was a woman who was riding the subway in New York late at night, and there's a father got on with these two kids, and the two kids were younger, and they were totally out of control. And as I heard this, it was told to a Buddhist teacher who told it, and now it's like become totally out there famous. And she was just getting more and more irritated as the kids were running around. She's thinking, what kind of a incompetent father is this, who's in not even teaching his kids manners and letting them go bouncing off the walls and screaming in the subway and disturbing everyone. And so she finally, and he's just totally there spacing out. And so she went up to him and said, excuse me, could you kind of rein your kids in? I mean, it's New York. She was probably not even that polite. And he said, oh, it kind of came to me. He called him to him, and he said, I'm so sorry, my wife's dying of cancer, and we just went to visit her, and she doesn't have that many days left. And so I just kind of stopped paying attention, you know, And then what happened to her heart, right? Bang. You know, went from irritation to compassion. So she didn't know that story, right? So our stories are just our stories. And one of the things, like when I see young people that look young and healthy, and they're one of the things I know because of the field I used to work in with the nonprofit health center, is that the majority of those kids have had horrible traumatic abuse in their past lives. And so I just make up a story about them. And I may choose not to give them money, or I may choose to, if I have time, to actually talk to them. But the thing I'm responsible for is my own heart, right? So I just feel like what I can do is say, make up a story that takes, that creates that same shift on me that that woman went through on the subway. So when I look at that kid, instead of being irritated with them or thinking, you know, you could be working, you could get it together and get a job, I just think, it could be amazing that you're alive. You know, it could just be amazing that you're functioning well enough to be here having a conversation with someone, and you're not in jail, you haven't killed them. You know, it's just like, you haven't killed yourself. You know, I literally will go through that. And then I check in with my own heart as to whether it's right to give to them or not, or have a conversation. But the first step I can take is stop that kind of violence of overlaying my own story on them instead of having a compassionate heart. And why I say violence is because that separation is where we end up with wars, right? We don't stop to listen to each other's stories. And I think, I don't know, because I haven't had Sunil's class, so I'm probably like building it up here. But that's why I love nonviolent communication, because what it is here you are with your experiences and feelings and needs, and here I am over here, and we have both sitting in totally different places, and we have our own stories going, how the heck are we going to communicate? Let alone compassionately, right? Am I getting it right at all?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so in nonviolent communication, they talk about enemy images. So
uh-huh.
You can see somebody and create an image of them, which is the enemy image, and then through the practice, hopefully come to a place of seeing that they're also human and they have needs.
Right.
That's the
great.
Piece.
Perfect.
But
yeah.
It is a practice. It isn't a, you know, it is a practice.
Yeah.
Capacity.
So it's a not make the enemy story or work with the enemy story. Then from that place, compassion is not always weak. That's idiot compassion, okay? Sometimes compassion means now that you have clear view and you love and you have compassion for them and you're meeting their suffering with loving kindness, you go and you get fierce with them. And this is where, you know, this is like where it gets tricky. This is wisdom. I mean, if it's appropriate, you could think, you know, if I go and really talk to this person in this way right now, it might be what gets through to them and helps them, you know, change their life. So the face part of it, and that's like, again, we don't have time to go into all of this, but sometimes a strong response is important, right? But we can only do that once we have compassion. That's what the Buddha taught. Okay? All right. Another story that I like is that if you walk by, you're in the forest and you walk by a dog and the dog's lunging at you, like, you know, wants to come after you. And you're like freaked out, like, where is it? You know, what the heck's going on with that dog? Someone should get under control. And then you look closer and you realize it's walked into like a bear trap or something and its back paw is caught and it's in pain. Then you're, again, your heart goes from this fear, irritation, anger response to compassion response. And so it is, I love that thing, it's the enemy story that we put the other, the label of the other and the enemy, and that helps us. The reason it's important is it helps us shut our own heart down, and then we've stopped connection and there's no place to go there except more separation. Okay, so that's the short version. All right, so what we can do, newspaper clippings. If you read a newspaper story, you can do either one of the compassion meditations that we did. Like, you can just say, may you be free, you know, from suffering and its causes. May you be free from mental suffering. May you be free, just at whoever you're reading about, right? And you may cry. You can have feelings come up. You just keep that going. May you be free from physical suffering. May you be free from emotional suffering. You know, may you, and then, you know, may you have all ease of well-being, something like that. And you can, or you can do the Tonglen meditation that we did earlier. So you see that person, you read about that person in the newspaper, like, I don't know, I mean, it just totally, anyway, I'll leave that. And you take their, you see yourself taking their pain away, having it, it's really important to have the confidence that as soon as it touches the diamond and the rose in your heart, it poofs, it's gone, you've destroyed it, and it was your willingness to take it on and take it away from them that destroys it, the pain forever. So neither of you has it, it's totally out of your body, you've just taken it away from them, and then you see them, you see that they're free of it, okay? Emergency vehicles. If whenever I, this is my practice, whenever I hear a siren, I immediately go into a compassion meditation. And I heard this amazing story once. A woman was in a car accident and she was on the side of the road and she left her body, you know? And when you leave your body, I don't, have any of you had that experience? I did when I was 3 years old. And I almost died. And I, oh yeah, I totally remembered it. And I, you know, when you're young, you don't think that it's weird. It just happened. No one told you, oh, people don't usually do that, right? So, so I think it's normal. So I remember telling my mom about it and what I saw and everything, and she was just blown away. She's like, what? Because I had my particular stuffed animal right next to me. And so there's no way, and I knew what the bed color, the bedspread was like, and we had moved by that time, and you know, the all that. Anyway, so when you have that state, you actually can hear and see things like from a distance. It's like your consciousness perceives, because if we're Buddhists, we know, understand that the mind, and it's not the same as the brain, that awareness can do things that the brain is not aware. Yes, anyway. So she did that. And so she could hear people's thoughts as they were driving by. And she said what she heard, or as they were in that region, was, oh my God, you know, I'm going to be late for work. Or, you know, I can't believe I'm going to get stuck in this traffic. Can they get this accident out of here? You know, just things like that, all about I. And she said then one person came through and was saying, oh, it just starts saying like a type of prayer for her. I hope she's, may she be okay. May her family be okay. May she, you know, if she's, I hope, may she still heal from whatever happens. May she be reunited with her loved ones. Just, and she said, it's like actually helped her come back into her body. She said, and she never, ever forgot that person. And that was her path to becoming a Buddhist, actually, was when she found the compassion prayer and the four immeasurables. She realized that the woman had been doing like a version of that, and she said that one, just that one person's compassion that was thinking about her and her family and wishing her well and praying for her in that way, we could call it praying maybe, that it just guided her home back into her body. So you know, if it were a movie, she would have reunited with that woman, you know, recognized her voice and something. But that didn't happen, or at least when I heard the story, it hadn't yet. So I, like, literally when I'm in my backyard and I hear a siren, you know, I just go into that, or I really protect my mind. Like I got stuck on the freeway the other day, coming back from visiting Santa Cruz, and the whole freeway was totally, totally closed down. I couldn't see what was happening, and it was like, you know, almost whatever, mile and a half of no exit. I couldn't even get off and go have a coffee. So I was just stuck on the freeway. And I just remember the whole time I was struggling with my own mind because of that story and because of what I know. And I just kept saying, no, you know, you gotta, yes, recognize you feel irritation in your body right now, recognize that this is true, you're feeling this, and then how do you feel for this person? Imagine them right now, how scared they must be. How, you know, so it's like, I hope help comes soon. I hope that you aren't injured and that all of you in the car are safe. And, you know, I just went in to that, and sometimes you have to work it, right? But I have to say, the difference in my life, if I take it back to me, the end of whatever it was, half an hour, 45 minutes, or whatever, being stuck there doing that instead of the mantra of I'm so irritated.
Yeah.
I mean, just that alone, even if you don't believe the other stuff, you know, just look at the how it is in your life. And then the third one is towards a neutral person like the cashier. And I don't know why I keep using the cashier as my neutral person, either that or the mailman. We have a mailman.
The emergency person's neutral.
And the emergency person, the person...
Everyone.
Yeah, that's true. But I think I have more charge there because I'm imagining him injured. So I kind of have almost more of a compassionate love. A neutral person for me is someone I wouldn't naturally even think about having compassion for. Because one of the things with compassion and loving kindness is you have to stop and look at the person and see how they're doing. So what I try and do now is I look at a cashier, and if they're not looking stressed, I send them loving kindness and I do loving kindness practice towards them. But if I see that they're stressed, and sometimes I imagine, like that girl, like everything is like, you imagine all these hungry, tired people at 5 o'clock or 5:30 trying to go through the line, and they just all want to get their food and go home, and they're getting irritated at everyone around, including you as the cashier. Mm-hmm. So in that moment, like that, if I actually wouldn't notice that moment of their suffering unless I was doing it as a practice. So that's kind of what I mean by a neutral person, is like, for me, that's another way of talking about a neutral person. And that the classic way is someone that you love, someone who's neutral, and someone who's an enemy, meaning their relationship to you. So that's what Ryan's saying, is like a person who is on the side of the road, if I don't know them, is a neutral person to me. So in this case, I actually, like I said, have to work to notice, first of all, that there's another human being that might be having their own experience, and that experience might be suffering or unpleasant. And then I'll just stand there in line and either do Tonglen for them, just see all their stress of the day and take it, and then I give them back ease and happiness and imagine all the customers thanking them and being nice to them and making them laugh and, you know, just things like that. So you can practice. Those are daily ways you can bring it into your life. You can, I didn't say this, but you can do it at work. It's one of the ways you can transform your work, is you look at people and you see if they're looking stressed or they're having trouble at work or they're struggling under the project deadline. Sit there and as you're typing away or doing whatever you're doing, do a compassion practice for them, right? So that's how you can bring it into your daily life. Any other suggestions or thoughts or things that people have done that work for them?
It helps me not get really angry at people who pass me. Like, anyone who passes me has the potential to make me annoyed, no matter what. Even if there's two lanes and they're just going by, but it helps me if they're, like, speeding by, to think, I hope they get where they want to get safely and quickly and are successful in whatever they're doing. Something like that. It just helps me to feel more loving towards them and not go to the place of competitive.
I got to step on the gas.
It's not logical, no.
Yeah.
Hey. Actually, when you do balancing poses in yoga, it can be really difficult if there's people in front of you wobbling.
Uh-huh.
And so they say, like, use your drishti, like, just look there, like, don't
mm-hmm.
look at them.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually find if I stare at them and root for them, then I'm balancing.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
That's a good one.
She's my big nemesis these days.
Remember when you were 15
yeah.
and have compassion for that
yeah,
one.
Right?
We didn't even talk about self-compassion. That was
in
my...
Yeah, well, I have compassion,
yeah.
but I want to say...
Yeah, I'll go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not an early bird. I don't like to get out of bed early. I can wake up early, but not this morning I get to start work early. And drive all the way from Rancho Cordova to New Thomas for my work was this morning, trying
okay.
to be there at 8:15. So I did make it through traffic and everything. And when I get there, I noticed that I forgot my keys.
Oh no!
And I get three places to clean today. and I go home, shower. Okay. So I have to go home in the traffic again and come back again. And when I get there, I was like, okay, I need to smile to my day today. I don't want to ruin my day. If I don't make it to the class, things happen for a reason. I'm not going to ruin my whole day just because I didn't check my book out of the keys.
And then
go through your day. Yeah, go through your day.
That's great.
Do what you need to do. What is more important? Well, my responsibility is my work. And that's
sweet.
What pays for my home, right?
Right.
So do that, and if you have a chance, then you go to the group. If you don't, namaste.
Oh, sweet.
Nice.
Nice.
It was a long drive, yeah. 2 hours in traffic.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
At
8,
9,
that's great. Yeah. So you have to do it towards yourself. And that's so important, yeah? Because it changes, like you said, it changes your day.
I got to do what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to ruin my whole day and
yeah.
fighting and being, you know, in my head
right.
is the worst part sometimes.
Yeah.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Right. And you make yourself your own enemy in your head, right? Yeah.
Oh, very good at doing that.
Yeah, I think we all are. Good, well done. Okay, cool. Any last questions or thoughts on compassion on our... So then the next one, the next that we'll at least start with in the last minutes here, is sympathetic joy. Or empathetic joy, or rejoicing. Those are all ways to talk about it. And I love it. It says here, this is actually a quote from one of the early suttas. It says, learn to share the joy of others by cultivating sympathetic joy. You gain the ability to abandon all discontent. You gain the ability to abandon all discontent. That's a pretty intense promise, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So, what is sympathetic joy? May all mother beings never, sentient beings never be separated from the bliss that knows no suffering. That's the highest expression of it, which goes back to the very first class we talked about, which is genuine happiness. And we talked about genuine happiness versus the treadmill of running after pleasure and then having it end, and that we see our happiness is out there, and that genuine happiness comes from within. Sounds really cliche when I put it this quickly, but it's true, you know, that it's that sense of it's what we bring to the world instead of what we get from the world. And I always like to use the example, because most of us have felt this, that you fall in love with someone and then you float through your day and it doesn't matter what happened. Someone can cut you off. Someone can, you know, at work can be mean to you. You're like, it doesn't matter. You're floating, right? You're happy. So that's a happiness that is really coming from in you, that you're bringing to your day, that has no dependence on what comes at you, right? And so basically that's a touchstone for saying, if you could do it then, it's actually an experience that's available to all of us. It kind of blows your mind, right? And it's really, I mean, it's one of my kind of why I love doing long retreats, because it's something that happens when I'm in a long meditation retreat. I come back and the world kind of looks like that for a while. You know? So empathetic joy, It's really interesting, because one of the things that when I was reading about it, someone brought up this point. You know about our negativity bias? Does everyone know about our inborn negativity bias? Which has been well documented, that we all have a bias to one degree or another to register what's negative in our life more easily and as being more important than what's going well in our lives. Or what's positive. And that's a survival mechanism, because there's that example that if there's a movement in the bushes back in the day when we lived with tigers, and we have two mistakes we could make. What's mistake number one? We could think it's a tiger and it's not. Or we can make the mistake of thinking it's not a tiger, and then what happens? It's the last mistake you ever make. Right? So we have a survival bias towards negativity, meaning reading the same information as a potential threat, and then that staying in our body physiologically and being in this fight, flight, or freeze mode much longer than registering something that was kind of nice, like birds singing, like, or something just kind of a quote-unquote normal, nice experience. It doesn't really go into our memory banks and get imprinted physiologically the same way or as easily. So what sympathetic or empathetic joy does, or rejoicing, it literally, part of why it begins to gain the ability to abandon our discontent is because that constant negativity bias, it spins in our mind like it registers, and then we work the story over and over and over again, and we ruminate and perseverate, and it gets built up, and we actually keep it going way further than it needs to. And the habit of sympathetic joy begins to counter that. Right? So it's a way of really cultivating a sense of ease and contentment. The path to freedom, which is a first century Buddhist text by Upatissa, described it like this. Because we keep going back to parents, it's really interesting. This is all examples quoted by monks, right? So they're not parents in the old days, but they all use parents or mothers. As parents who, on seeing the happiness of their dear and only child, are glad, right? So you're a parent, and you see your child happy, and it makes you happy, right? It's just this, again, this natural, because all of these things are abilities, they're experiences we have, they're inborn to us, and then we can cultivate them and grow them. That's the whole idea. It's not like we have to make them happy. They're already happen. They're already there and accessible. And so they're glad and they say, sadhu, sadhu. Right? And so sadhu, sadhu is like, kind of like wonderful, wonderful, or great, great. That's great. Yeah. Someone develops appreciative joy. That's another way it's translated. Appreciative joy, which is kind of a sweet way, for all beings. Thus should appreciative joy be known, the undisturbed dwelling of the mind in appreciative joy. This is called the practicing of it. In other words, the undisturbed dwelling, hanging out in the with the mind in sympathetic joy, is called practicing it. Gladness is its major feature. It's kind of cool. Gladness is its major feature. And non-fear is its function, right? So the function of our negativity bias is fear. Appreciative joy is non-fear. Destruction of dislike is its manifestation. Okay, so the constant dislike, judgmental dislike we have that comes up so often, is destroyed. Again, counteracted and destroyed by this practice. And its benefits are equal to those of loving kindness, which, you know, we went over a whole list of loving kindness benefits, right? So then how do you practice it? When you see, or if you want to hear it in the language of the translation, when one sees or hears that someone's personal qualities are esteemed by others, and that they are at peace and joyful, one thus thinks, sadhu, sadhu, may they continue joyfully for a long time. Okay? So in other words, when you see or hear that someone's, it's interesting, it says qualities, but we'll talk about that, are esteemed by others, praised by others, or you notice that someone has good qualities, someone's done good in the world, then you go, wonderful, wonderful, that's great. May that continue. May that person continue joyfully for a long time. Right. So we have two things going on here in both examples, and seeing the happiness of one's dear and only child, and hearing or seeing that someone's personal qualities are esteemed by others. One is the person is already happy. Right? We didn't do anything to make them happy. We didn't do anything to make them generous. We didn't do anything to make them wise. We're just seeing and appreciating. That's why I'm liking more and more this translation of bodhipakshas of appreciative joy. That's kind of cool, isn't it? Like sympathetic joy. Sympathy, I always think someone's like been a sympathy card. It's hard for me to see sympathetic joy, even though technically it makes sense. But appreciative joy is pretty cool.
But joy is contagious too, you know, when you see somebody
yeah.
being lit up or if someone laughs really hard.
Right.
You get that too.
That kind of joy. And then that sense that what makes it appreciative joy or sympathetic joy is that you're happy that that person is happy. Okay? So you are happy that that person, you're rejoicing in that person's goodness. Does this make sense? So what's really pointed at here is a person's qualities, but we can do this with their good fortune as well, right? So you want to, the Buddha said, you really look at qualities. So I always imagine people that are, it's easy for me, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I just have to think about him, and he's so full of good qualities. So then I'm just happy about all the goodness. You rejoice in all the goodness and his good qualities. But the far enemy of this is, can anyone guess what it might be? What would be the opposite? What's that?
Isn't it called, jealousy.
Jealousy, yeah.
It's a German word. Were you
Freudenschaft? Oh, Schadenfreude. Yeah.
Sorry.
Kind of taking the joy in someone else's, well, difficulties. Yeah, so it's that thing of envy, which is actually in a certain way you see someone happy or having good fortune, and you feel jealous, envious, and you actually secretly want them to be unhappy, and like you're, and especially if someone that gets a promotion at work or gets praised by their boss, right? Are we taking joy in their happiness?
Not usually.
Yeah. So, that's, I think, let's leave it there. And...
That's a
glue hanger. Or we can stay... we can stay another half hour. That would be okay. What's that?
What's the near enemy?
Yeah, that makes
sense. Okay, well, I think I want to ask, so I'll leave this as homework, two things. One is, look around and do you notice, just notice, are you noticing other people's good qualities? Like the goodness that they do? The small kindnesses that they do? You know, look and see what you take for granted in other people that's actually maybe a good quality in them. And see what it feels like to rejoice in that, right? And then notice the flip side. How, if, and if so, or not, you might not be, but are you, if you scan, do you notice any envy or jealousy and kind of if someone's doing something well, like a yoga pose, you know? If you see that someone's holding their balance really, really well in a really difficult pose, are you rejoicing for them? Or is there some envy coming up and a little secret delight if they start to wobble? You know, and because all this starts within us and being really honest about scanning what's happening inside of us. And then the Buddha is saying, if you do A, you're going to be kind of more unhappy than if you do B. So here's, first thing is notice what you're doing. And then if you want to be happier, I'll give you a way to work with that, right?
You feel both at the same time?
That's a good question. You can't do both at the same time, but you can do both at the same time. You can. That's actually called practicing. Because if you notice that you're feeling envious, and then you know, like you did this morning, well, I could have my whole day ruined if I let my mind go like this, or I could approach it this way and I'll be happier. You know, that it would be the same thing. So eventually, if you continue both, the idea is that the part that's envious begins to die down, and the part that's rejoicing gets stronger and more automatic. Because whatever we attend to, whatever we feed, gets stronger. Yeah. All right. Cool. So everyone, what's your homework?
Look at the small kindnesses.
Celebrate people's strengths.
Celebrate people's strengths. Notice if you're not celebrating them, what you do. And what did you say loudly?
Notice the small kindnesses that people do.
Notice the small kindnesses people do. The good things that you can rejoice about them. And guess what? You could even do it about yourself if you want to get really radical. All right. Okay, we'll do our closing prayers. And again, we offer this pure world with this sense that we've done something really amazing to create this. We've planted intense positive karmic seeds that will help us create this pure world. And then we dedicate it that everybody benefit. Thank you everyone for coming tonight, and have a wonderful week, and hope to see you for our last class next week. And we'll end with, again, three prostrations that you're welcome to join in or not.
I'll bring it in. I left my iPhone.